Hello, Florida Bar members and Florida registered paralegals. This is a quick reminder from the Standing Committee on Mental Health and Wellness of Florida Lawyers that you are approved to use the Florida Lawyers Helpline, a completely free and confidential around-the-clock helpline designed to support you in managing the challenges of both your personal and professional life. By dialing 833-FL1-WELL or 833-351-9355, you can connect with mental health professionals who are ready to assist you. Take advantage of up to 5 complimentary in-person or telehealth counseling sessions annually, and remember, there's no limit to the number of calls you can make. Reach out today.
You're listening to the Florida Bar Podcast, brought to you by the Florida Bar's Practice Resource Center, Legal Fuel. Produced by the broadcast professionals of the Florida Bar.
Welcome to the Florida Bar's Legal Fuel Podcast, brought to you by the Practice Resource Center of the Florida Bar. We are so glad you are joining us. This is Jamie Moore. I'm a practice management advisor at the Florida Bar and one of the hosts of the show, which is being recorded from our studio in Tallahassee, Florida. Our goal at the Practice Resource Center is to assist Florida attorneys with running the business side of their law practices. We focus on a different topic each month and carry the theme through our website with related tips, videos, and articles. Professionalism, ethics, and courtroom presence are vital tools for every attorney striving to deliver exceptional service and build a strong reputation. Today, we'll explore how these qualities can elevate an attorney's practice, enhancing credibility with judges, clients, and colleagues. Organizations like the American Inns of Court play a key role in promoting these standards, helping attorneys navigate the challenges of a demanding profession while upholding the values of integrity and civility. Joining us to share insights on courtroom decorum, oral argument tips, and the value of Florida Inns of Court is Judge Ross Bilbrey. Judge Bilbrey has been on the First District Court of Appeal since 2015. Prior to this, he was a circuit court judge in Pensacola beginning in 2012 and was appointed to the Santa Rosa County Court in 2006. He received his BA and his JD from the University of Florida. Before taking the bench, Judge Bilbrey was in private practice where he focused on civil and commercial litigation. He also served as a legal assistance attorney for the JAG Corps at the Naval Legal Service Office at NAS Pensacola. Judge Bilbrey is active in the American Inns of Court and previously served as president of the Pensacola chapter as well as president of the First DCA Appellate Inn here in Tallahassee. Welcome to the show, Judge Bilbrey.
Thank you, Jamie. I'm happy to be here today.
I'm super excited to have you here. Thank you so much. So Judge Bilbrey, let's start by discussing the American Inns of Court. Their website states that their mission is to inspire the legal community to advance the rule of law by achieving the highest level of professionalism through example, education, and mentoring. Could you explain what the Inns of Court is and tell us about how you first got involved with a local inn?
Sure. To understand the American Inns of Court, you need to understand a little bit about the English Inns. And the English Inns are how English barristers, even to this day, finalize their legal education. And England has the barristers who are basically the trial attorneys and the solicitors who do more of the office work, although they can go into court sometimes nowadays too. But in the 1300s or so, the Inns of Court came about as a way to formalize the legal education and to have societies where lawyers would train together, work together, practice in close proximity, and live together. And that continues to this day. So in the late 70s, early 80s, there was something of a sense that the professionalism was lacking a little bit in the U.S., civility lacking, professional ethics lacking to some extent. And there was interaction between U.S. and U.K. lawyers and judges, which led to the formation of the first Inn of Court in Utah. And Chief Justice Warren Burger, who was the Chief Justice of the U.S. Supreme Court at the time, was involved in this Inn of Court movement and helped get federal judges involved through the Federal Judicial Conference. And they started expanding then throughout the 80s. And even to this day, I think the inns are still expanding to the extent that there's now 40 inns or so in the state of Florida. And the inns, although certainly not near as formal as the English inns, not required for anybody to complete their legal education. But the inns are a way for lawyers and judges to interact with each other, to engage in some legal education, to hopefully engage in some mentoring, typically share a meal together and interact in a social environment and a learning environment at the same time.
That's really interesting that it went back so far, and here we are, and it's still going and still growing.
And in fact, the American Inn still does interaction with the UK Inn so that they send some new attorneys over to do a six-week internship each summer with the UK Inns and learn some more about what's going on in the English Inns of Court over there. So there's still interaction. They invite us to some of their continuing legal education. So I've seen Zooms from barristers over there, UK judges, putting on presentations of professionalism and explaining to us some of the English legal system. So it's a good interaction between both of the U.S. and the English Inns of Court.
What would you say is the biggest difference, though, between their inn there and versus the
sure,
U.S.?
Sure. I mean, well, their inns, they have physical structure. So there's four inns that are currently in operation in the U.K., and they have large buildings like a college campus with offices, dining hall, places for lecture. I think they have libraries. The barristers can keep their chambers there where they do their work there. So it's a lot more loose here. So in Pensacola, for instance, we would do the presentations in the courthouse, either the state or federal courthouse, and then go to a local restaurant for dinner. The First District Inn, we're able to do the presentation in-house and then have dinner in-house since we control the facility there. But different inns do it different ways. But no inn that I'm aware of owns a facility or has near the setup that the English inns have.
That's very neat. So who can join an inn, and what about law students? Is it open to them?
At least in our inn and then a number of inns. I know Gainesville inns, there's two inns down there and they have law students. So a number of the inns do have law students open to them. If somebody is interested in joining the inns, the Inns of Court website has information on how to find inns in your area that you might be interested in joining. But typically, at least from the inns that I've been associated with, around springtime, they start recruiting for the next inn year. And at least in our inns, we didn't have programs during the summer because people are traveling, the students are out of school and such. So our programs run from September till May. April, May timeframe, we start looking for people for the new year. And then by midsummer or so, decide who's going to be accepted. For the law students, I know we recruit FSU and UF law students for our inn. And if law students happen to be listening and are interested in doing that, they can contact the universities. But we solicit down there to try to get some students involved with that. And we typically have about 10 law students or so a year with the appellate inn who are involved with that. And I believe the Stafford Inn, which is the more general purpose inn here in town, has law students too. The inns can be both general purpose or specialty inns. So obviously the First District Appellate Inn of Court is a specialty inn specializing in appellate practice. I think there's at least one other appellate inn in the state. There are a number of workers' compensation inns in the state that practice exclusively in that area. There are some family law inns in the state. And I think there's some inns that are set up for trial, more specifically for trial practice too. Although trial practice, it seems like a lot of the inn members, even in the general inns, are primarily attorneys who engage in litigation.
And that's great. So law students can also participate in practice area specific parts of the inn, which I think is fantastic because that would give them a little sampling of what it might be like if they decide to go in that direction.
Correct. And it's a good way for them to interact with, practitioners in that area. So, if they're looking to practice in the appellate area when they're out of school, this gets them the opportunity to interact with appellate practitioners. And like you said, see if this is something they want to do. And if it's something they want to do, they've met some people who are already practicing in that area, perhaps they can find some job opportunities available to them in that area and certainly get some education in the specific practice area.
Okay, that's great information. And I do know we have following, you know, at FSU School of Law. So for any of those listeners, you would recommend that they reach out to the College of Law and they would most likely have information.
Correct. Information. We would start recruiting in the spring for the next practice year. Typically, second and third year students in, you know, rising second or third year students. So a first year student now who's going to be second year in the next academic year would be eligible to apply.
Okay. Very good. So what do you see as the most important benefits to young attorneys participating in the Ends of Court program?
Sure. Mentoring, I think, is a good aspect of it. The interaction with attorneys is a good aspect of it. When I practiced in Jacksonville for 7 years before I went back home to Pensacola, and although I knew people in Pensacola, I didn't know all that many attorneys because I hadn't practiced law there, and I think it was just at the courthouse or maybe on the website for the local Pensacola Escambia Santa Rosa Bar Association that the Inn was recruiting people. And I didn't really know much about it. So I did a little exploring, applied, and was fortunate to be accepted. But it was a great way for me to meet attorneys and judges in the Pensacola area who I, you know, would not have otherwise had the opportunity to interact with. So the Inn was very helpful in helping me to integrate into the Pensacola legal community. And one of the reasons why I'm such a big supporter of the Inn is I don't think that I likely would have become a judge had I not been an Inn member, because not that many people would have known me just back in town, back home for six and a half years when I was appointed as a judge.
And I like how you pointed out the mentoring aspect, because I do feel like, and I didn't go to law school myself, but those that, you know, graduate from law school, you're just out in the world and it's like, what do I do? You know, where do I go? And, you know, that sounds like such a great.
And I know a number of practitioners. I mean, obviously, if you've come in and you're in a big law firm and they're going to have a standardized program and, you know, probably assign you a mentor and work you through different departments and those kind of things. But I know a lot of people, you know, just hang out a shingle and they don't really have anybody to turn to. So the Inn is a good way to do that. I know that Lawyers Helping Lawyers that the bar has, and that's available on the bar website, is a program that helps the mentoring of young attorneys. So there are programs out there. The local bar associations, for instance, in Tallahassee, the Tallahassee Bar Association, Tallahassee Women Lawyers, Tallahassee Barristers, and other local bar associations, a good way to meet people in the community and try to get some involvement in particular practice areas.
Yes. And I will include a link on that. I'm glad that you mentioned that program. It's Counsel to Counsel, our new mentoring program. And the other one is Lawyers Advising Lawyers. Okay. Not a mentoring program, but it does connect attorneys with other attorneys if you have a question, legal advice.
I appreciate you clarifying. Yes. Combined both programs in my mind. So Counsel to Counsel and then Lawyers to Lawyers is when you have the practice-specific area.
Yes.
And you need some help with that. So thank you. Yes. Good point.
Still on the topic of mentoring, how does the Ends of Court foster mentorship and knowledge sharing between judges, experienced attorneys, and newer members of the profession? So is there a means of getting that information between the parties?
Sure. We have a formal mentoring program at the First Appellate Inn where new attorneys can get assigned a specific mentor who's in the appellate practice area. So, you know, we have a formalized program. I'm not sure if all Inns do that. I don't recall that necessarily have that in all of the Inns, but we have the formal mentoring program, rather. But even without the formal mentoring program, the educational programs that are part of the Inns that are put on where, you know, you hear potentially a practice area that you may not have any experience with, or you hear somebody, you know, lawyers, judges who are experienced in the area putting on some CLE that's hopefully going to help with a new attorney's practice. And then additionally, there's the social aspect of the Inns where you're sitting down, like, in, you know, again, taken from the English Inns, sitting down for a meal together and interacting in that way, too.
And what is the time, I guess, time commitment, if for those that may be interested in looking into this?
Not a huge time commitment. I mean, we have a program that's between the social hour, the program, and the dinner. It's probably 2.5-3 hours, one time a month during the 9 months or so that we have programs, 8 months. So, and then when you put on the CLE, one team is typically in charge of that. So they have to do the work of putting that together. So that, you know, that could take 10, 15 hours maybe to do that. But I would think the total time commitment for somebody would probably be less than 30 hours for the course of the year, maybe 40 hours at most, but it's not a huge time commitment.
And seems well worth it, though.
Yeah, absolutely. Absolutely.
Very good. Well, I wanted to shift gears and talk now about courtroom decorum and oral argument tips. So I know you can share a lot of insight into this. So first, I wanted to talk to you about strategies that new attorneys can use to prepare for trial or oral argument.
Sure. Trial first. Obviously, preparation is going to be key. The new rules of civil procedure coming in place as of January 1 are going to be a whole sea change from what attorneys are used to in the trial area. So instead of being attorney directed, it's going to be more like the federal system and more judge directed, and kind of more similar to how criminal dockets seem to go, with the judge setting dates and timelines and the attorneys knowing those. So some of that is going to be built into the new civil rules of procedure that the attorneys are going to have to comply with. But even notwithstanding that, preparation for trial is obviously important. You've got to know what you're going to put on in terms of evidence. Have to know then how you're going to get that evidence into it before the jury, before the judge, before whoever's trying the case. So I used to have, and still do somewhere in my office, my actual trial notebook with those evidentiary foundations. So you know what questions to ask. So if you blank out in the middle of the trial while you're trying to get an exhibit in, you can just refer to that. That's the kind of preparation, you know, knowing the what's got to be put on, trying to do the pretrial motions to narrow the issues through partial summary judgment or whatever the motions may be, motions in limine to try to include or exclude evidence before trial. So as much of that legwork that you can do pretrial would be helpful. For oral argument then, I mean, oral argument, people see that and think that's the main focus of appellate practice. Really, oral argument doesn't happen in all that many cases. And by the time it happens, all of the briefing is completed. So, you know, I would, my first suggestion for oral argument would be focus on the briefs. And if you get to oral argument and if oral argument is granted, great. But, you know, don't make that the focus of the case. The briefs are the main focus of the case and how the case may well be decided. But if you get to oral argument, again, it's organization, it's knowing the record, and that's a pet peeve of many judges when somebody at oral argument says, I didn't try the case, when you ask them a question about, well, didn't this go on at trial? Well, I didn't try the case. I'm just on the appeal. No, the attorney needs to know the record and know what's gone on at trial and be able to talk to us about that. Obviously, know the key cases, including your best cases and your opponent's best cases. And then anticipate what we're going to ask. And that helps to have other practitioners that you can have help you moot the arguments and anticipate what the judges are going to throw at you during oral argument. So all of that is helpful. And then in the argument itself, know hopefully it's going to be conversational. And when we're asking questions, that's what we want to talk about and focus on. And sometimes attorneys have their notes and their outline, and they want to get back to their notes and outline. But when we're asking about some particular issue, that's obviously a key focus of the case, at least for that judge, maybe for all three judges on the panel, or seven justices if you're talking about the Supreme Court. So that's what the attorney needs to talk about, at least until the judges are satisfied with their answer on that particular issue, and not try to just focus on their script. And sometimes I see young lawyers think that they've got to get out, you know, what they've got written down and what they've outlined beforehand, when really it should be more of what the judges are asking about.
And I could see where the outline might throw someone off, because you're so focused on the outline that maybe you're not even hearing, right, you know, what is being asked of you, and you're kind of missing the mark.
Right. No, and that's a very good point. Sometimes the attorneys, especially younger, less experienced attorneys, may not see that, you know, we're trying to talk about things either, you know, might be issue number 5 on your outline, or it might be something totally off your outline altogether, but you should be prepared to talk about that. Or if we've just thrown such a curveball that it's outside of what you'd prepared for altogether, that's fine too, to say, I don't know. But at least talk to us about that. And, or judge, I don't understand the question. Can you, you know, are you talking about this? Try to get us back on track if we've asked something so out of left field that the attorney doesn't understand what we're asking about. But hopefully we're asking about the things that they know that are part of their outline, but that's part of their outline that we want to focus on.
And is anything submitted prior to this? I mean, just, I'm not well versed on the whole process, but is there something that's usually submitted to the judge and then
sure, I mean,
feedback is received?
So that's the brief part of it. So, you know, typically for the appellate process, you've got an order of the trial court, and that may be order granting summary judgment, a jury verdict with a dollar amount in a civil case, or perhaps a jury verdict finding no liability, so a $0 amount. Or in a criminal case, it's the judgment and sentence, you know, somebody's sent to prison for 30 years. Or in an administrative case, it may be a final agency order. So we've got that from the lower tribunal. And then we've got the full record, everything that went on in the lower tribunal as far as the filings, the various pleadings and such, potentially exhibits, if they're made part of the record, those kind of things. So we have all of that. Then before the parties start filing their briefs, the person who is bringing the appeal, then the appellant files an initial brief. The person who's responding to that, the appellee, would file an answer brief, and then the appellant gets to file a reply brief. For oral argument, we have all of those papers beforehand, and the attorneys have all of those papers too. So they know, you know, this is not just coming out of left field. They hopefully have an idea what the issues are and what we're going to be talking about when we get to oral argument, because they've, you know, looked at the record, they've looked at their briefs, they've looked at the other side's briefs, they've looked at the key cases in those briefs. So they at least have a pretty good idea of what the main focus is going to be at argument.
Okay. That's good to know. So what do new attorneys need to know about appropriate communication with a judge when they have a pending matter in court? So I'm sure you've seen inappropriate and appropriate, and maybe you could just
sure. I mean, share. You know, and obviously, you know, you can't engage in ex parte communication, the you know, one sided communication with the judge. So that's in the ethics side, and hopefully the attorneys are going to be well versed and know not to do that. So it's more the professionalism side where the communication comes in. I think it's important not to waste the judge's time, especially trial judges. They're pretty busy. So to argue only the things really that need to be brought before the judge. So you sometimes see people arguing about silly discovery disputes, those kind of things that you would hope that reasonable attorneys would be able to work out. So that's the first thing, is try to work things out. And don't even get before the judge if you don't have to. It needs to be something that's important that the attorneys are unable to resolve on their own. If it needs to come before the judge, make sure that any papers, any pleadings that you filed are well researched. You know, that's kind of goes into professionalism. You don't want something sloppy. You don't want something that is skewed in any way, that doesn't cite, you know, if your opponent has a great case right on point, you need to come right out and talk about that and explain to the judge why that case may not actually be on point, or why some other case is a better case for the judge to use. So, you know, don't try to hide the ball from the judge. Judges don't like that. When you're arguing in front of a judge, certainly be civil and respectful to the other side. We take on sometimes, we certainly, as lawyers, you have to take on your client's problems, but you don't have to take on the acrimony and the emotion that they may have to the other side. So, you know, family law case where both sides have just unable to communicate, the attorney still should be able to communicate. They should still be able to effectively present their client's cases without it getting acrimonious, without voices being raised, without the anger. You know, focus on the issues And it seems like sometimes attorneys feel the need to perform for their clients, to show their clients that they're really on their side and they are going to advocate for them 100%. But you can do that without being, you know, frankly, a jerk about it. You can do that by having a persuasive and well-organized presentation for the judge and not being somebody who's just there trying to perform for your client and more concerned about that and what your client thinks than the outcome. And I've unfortunately seen that a few times back when I was a trial judge. We see that less on the appeals court, obviously. A smaller bar, the bar is generally very professional, but sometimes you get somebody who had been the trial attorney arguing their case on appeal, and they want to argue to the panel of three judges like they're arguing to a jury and making emotional pleas to us. And that's not what we're going to be swayed by. We're going to be swayed by the facts and the law and the appropriate standard of review. And not by some compelling argument, you know, one way or another, as far as who's the better person or who's got the, you know, the more emotional case or the more emotional set of facts on their side.
Okay. I mean, great tips there. So I'm sure there are clients who want their attorneys to be overly aggressive. And you mentioned that some attorneys might come in and, you know, maybe perhaps they're overdoing it. So are there, you know, and there are attorneys that advertise themselves that way as well. But how does maintaining appropriate decorum contribute to an attorney's credibility and effectiveness?
Sure. I mean, in the Supreme Court just recently had this with the zeal and the zealous, you know, and that's been part of the rules of professional conduct or the preamble to the rules of professional conduct. And it's just take a kind of an aside. The rules of professional conduct in Florida are really the ethics rules. So we talk about the rules of professional conduct, but those are the rules that you've got to comply with. If you don't follow those rules, then, you know, worst case scenario, you could be disbarred and you're no longer an attorney, right? So in the rules, there was a proposal to get rid of the use of the words zeal and zealous in those rules. Because some thought that encouraged unnecessarily, you know, combative behavior by the attorneys. And although the Supreme Court adopted a lot of the rule changes recently, and I think that was just a few months ago, maybe back in August or so of 24, they adopted a number of the proposals to make some additions and changes. But they didn't get rid of the zeal and the zealous language. And I think you can still zealously represent your attorney as an attorney represent your client without being overly aggressive in doing that. So that means, you know, some of the things that I've talked about, to be courteous and civil with the other sides, not to, you know, browbeat a witness, not to, you know, exaggerate or not to try to hide the ball, not to unnecessarily, you know, litigate things that don't need to be litigated, all of those kind of things.
And are there, you know, maybe specific forms of body language or verbal cues that you find particularly effective or ineffective during trial or oral argument? So we've kind of talked about behaviors, but can you share?
Sure.
A little bit
I
about
mean,
that?
And you know, you sometimes get that at oral argument. You see somebody like really shaking their head when the other side is talking. You know, giving you the big no head shake or something, and that can be distracting. So you don't want to see that at oral argument. The attorneys reacting too much to what the other side is saying. You know, like I was saying before, to the attorneys that are trying to put on their jury case and, you know, want to walk around like they're walking around in front of a jury and move from behind the lectern and, you know, acting, you know, get red in the face and pounding the podium. And again, we don't get that very often, but on the rare occasions when we do, that's not really effective argument. You know, misstating the record would certainly be an area that would be inappropriate communication, although obviously that's not nonverbal. That would be verbal. But Those kind of reactions. And you see that more in trial court, the nonverbal stuff. The witnesses shaking their heads, the people at the counsel table reacting to what somebody is saying.
We don't want to play out Suits or Ally McBeal.
Right, right. No, and I think that's some of it, too, and that goes to an important aspect of professionalism, is having your client, good communication with the client and setting expectations with the client on what you're going to do. Say, look, this is not TV. This is not, I'm not some TV lawyer that's going to yell and scream and make a big show for you. I'm going to put on the best organized, most effective case that I can for you. You know, now certainly if you're doing a closing argument or something in front of the jury, there's some acting that goes along with that within reason. But that doesn't mean that you have to be difficult on every point and everything in the case, that you can still be constrained in the presentation to the court, especially when it's just, with the judge and the other side, and you're not doing something in front of a jury. So, I think the effective client communication and setting expectations at the start with the client of what trial is, what it looks like, that this isn't TV, and that goes with the juries too. When you're addressing a jury, explaining to them that you're not a TV lawyer, and this is not CSI, and you don't have 50 different pieces of forensic evidence that you're going to give necessarily in a particular case, that explaining to them what to expect, and good attorneys I've seen have done that both in civil and criminal cases. Explain to the jury, what's going to be presented, and it's not going to look like something on TV necessarily. The justice system still works.
Right, because I do feel a lot of people are watching TV shows, clients perhaps, and they might be expecting that.
Oh, sure. And that doesn't mean to minimize how important this is for the client. I mean, this may be, the one time in their whole life that they're in court. And it could be, something as serious as somebody facing a life felony or having their child taken away from them. This is serious stuff that lawyers and judges do. But that doesn't mean that you have to put aside professionalism, civility, and those kind of behaviors in trying to make the best possible argument for your client.
And this ties into my next question. So in your experience, what mistakes in professional conduct or ethical lapses have you seen or perhaps could possibly lead to disciplinary actions against attorneys? And what steps can they take to avoid these pitfalls?
Sure. Failure to communicate with the client is certainly one of them. If you don't promptly return your calls, your client or emails or texts or whatever method you've explained to the client to best communicate. If you don't do that, that can be a professionalism problem. If you don't communicate with them at all, then that can be an ethical problem. So there's kind of a line and gradation. But I think it's good to explain, again, setting the expectations up front. If you're a one person or two person shop where you don't have a large staff that's going to be there at all time to take calls and respond to emails, explain to them that you're going to get back to them when you can, but that they shouldn't expect that you're going to return the call right away. So setting those kind of expectations with them. If you're in trial, having some kind of out of office or maybe having an answering service to be able to respond to them and let them know that you're in trial and that you're going to get back to them over the weekend or whenever the case may be, that you're actually going to have the time to do that. I talked about attention to detail, and that's certainly one aspect of professionalism, the poorly drafted document or making factual errors or cut and paste errors, those kind of things. lack of adequate preparation would go along with that. All of those things are things that you want to avoid in communicating.
And I spoke to a member once, and they told me how the best practice for them is they sent out a monthly, I guess you could say, invoice. And even if nothing was happening on the case, they would go ahead and list that. But at least still the client knew, hey, I haven't forgotten about you. I'm working on your case, you know, waiting for things to come in. Something's pending. And I thought that was fantastic. And they said they never had any issues because they had that regular communication.
No, and I think that's a good way to do it. Some kind of monthly update and let the clients know at the start. I mean, right. And maybe it's something that let them know too, that, you know, if this is an hourly case, they're going to be, okay, you want to call me every week and you expect me to return your calls, it's going to cost you. But communicating with them and letting them know what's going on is important. And that just seems to be a big area where attorneys and clients can get at odds with each other fairly easily if the communication is not there. And going along with that then is the attorney not taking on too many cases where he or she becomes so overloaded that they can't effectively communicate with the clients, or taking on cases in an area of practice that they have no background in and thinking that they're going to be able to do this as quickly and easily as cases that where they do have a background in it. So I'm not saying that attorneys shouldn't, you know, try to expand their area of practice or anything, but be careful when you do that, because you need to get educated on that area. You're going to be held to the same standards as the attorneys who have, you know, been practicing in that area for decades. It's going to take you time to do that. And your client needs to be prepared for that.
All good information. Great tips. So what advice would have been most helpful to you as a young attorney coming right out of law school and getting started?
Gosh, that's a great question. Most helpful. You know, I think finding a mentor would be helpful. I wish, you know, I'd heard kind of vaguely about the Inns of Court in Jacksonville, but didn't really follow up on it. And I wish I had, because they have now, I think, 4 great inns over there. I'm not sure how many when I was practicing over there, but that would have been, you know, something that I would have liked to have known. You know, getting involved in the local bar associations, various voluntary bars is, you know, something should have done sooner. And then being aware of the amount of, you know, there's only so much time in the day. So you've got to appropriately allocate that for, you know, work, but work is not everything. So, and as a young attorney, you think, you know, that you've got to just grind out so many billable hours, but there's got to be a balance. So, and I think, you know, I'm Gen X. I think the younger folks, the younger generations are probably a little more aware of setting appropriate boundaries, making appropriate time for themselves, and not, you know, not necessarily being in that, you know, all billable hours all the time grind that many people are in.
No, I think you're so right. I do appreciate that about the younger generation. I think they do value their time and taking, you know, time for their family, time for themselves, and just like you said, not working 80 hours a week and, you know, grinding yourself away. And I know there's lots of memes and things like that out there on Gen X that we grew up drinking water from the hose and out until the lights, you know, the street lights came on and all of that. I think right. It is true, but it's different.
Yeah. And the Gen X attorneys, you know, we were expected to, you know, billing was everything and working a lot. And I think the balance, you know, the younger attorneys, I think, are better focused on that reasonable work-life balance.
Yeah, I couldn't agree more. So to wrap up, I wanted to discuss your recent contribution to the appellate resources within the Florida Bar's Legal Publications Department. Can you share a little bit about that?
Yeah, thank you. I appreciate you asking me about that. The Florida Bar has a number of legal publications, and I was asked to work on a chapter on the Florida appellate practice, the revised edition. So I revised a chapter on certiorari jurisdiction. And certiorari is an old writ, used to be how the Florida Supreme Court would review cases. They don't even have certiorari jurisdiction anymore. It's how a case can be reviewed when there's not an avenue for appeal. So, for instance, if in the course of litigation, somebody is being asked to disclose privileged, you know, doctor-patient information that they contend is irrelevant, they could file a writ of certiorari with our court if the trial court, circuit court, county court has said you've got to produce that information. They could file a writ with our court to try to get that order quashed and keep the trial court from requiring that disclosure. And there's a number of other things that certiorari can do, but I was that's just kind of a general description of it. But I was able to revise that chapter and add some new cases and some updates. There's been a lot of changes with the Florida medical malpractice, and that was a big source of certiorari cases. But now some of those can be directly appealed. I was able to participate in the Florida appellate practice, and there's a number of chapters in that. And it's a good resource for practitioners. I don't get paid anything by it, so make that clear that I'm not encouraging anybody to buy it to line my pockets. But there's a number of good resources there for somebody who's a practitioner, and a number of law libraries throughout the state have it. So if you're not interested in spending the money to buy it, you know, I know when I had a new law firm in Pensacola, you know, it left the Navy base and started a firm with another guy there. I was very frequently over at the Escambia Law Library, and the Florida Bar publications were very useful in learning some practice areas or expanding my knowledge in practice areas. So definitely encourage folks to look at those if they're got some questions about a particular practice area.
Excellent. Thank you. Well, it looks like we've reached the end of our program. Thank you so much, Judge Ross Bilberry, for joining us today.
Thank you, Jamie. Appreciate you having me on, and enjoyed spending the time with you.
Judge Bilberry, if our listeners have questions, how can they learn more about the topics we discussed today?
Sure. The professionalism, the bar has a great website on professionalism, links to professionalism expectations, the rules for professional conduct, good CLEs, including some free CLEs. I know the Legal Fuel has a number of CLEs and podcasts available that include the ethics and professionalism topics. So if folks are interested in ethics or professionalism, I would advise them to take a look at the Florida Bar website. As far as Inns of Court, just type in American Inns of Court in any search engine, and you'll find the American Inns of Court website, and they have links there to list the various chapters throughout the state and whole country. And it also has a link on how to get involved if somebody's interested in trying to join a chapter. And you don't have to join a chapter. We frequently have guests for dinner. So just find somebody you know in a chapter and see if they could invite you to dinner one time and see if that's something that you might be interested in.
Perfect. If you like what you heard today, please rate us in Apple Podcasts. Join us next time for another episode of the Florida Bar's Legal Fuel Podcast, brought to you by the Practice Resource Center of the Florida Bar. I'm Jamie Moore. Until next time, thank you for listening.
If you'd like more information about today's show, please visit legalfuel.com. Don't miss an episode by subscribing to the Florida Bar's podcast via iTunes, Google Podcasts, Spotify, and RSS. Find the Florida Bar's Practice Resource Center, Legal Fuel, on Twitter, Facebook, and Instagram. The views expressed by the participants of this program are their own and do not represent the views of, nor are they endorsed by, the Florida Bar. None of the content should be considered legal advice. As always, consult a lawyer.